The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your jobs on all the top job sites. And now you can with ZipRecruiter.com. You can post your jobs to 200-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. North Korea tensions rise.
So you're saying if you feel that North Korea is going to be attacked, you will use nuclear weapons?
Also, the commissioner of the IRS hanging on as Republicans call on the president to fire him. We talk to him.
Are you committed to fulfilling your full term?
I'm committed to fulfilling the full term.
Later, Easter at the White House.
There are four pastel colors. The gold egg has the presidential seal.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Let's start this weekend with the week at the White House. CBS News political director Steve Chigueras is here in the Washington Bureau. Good to talk to you, Steve.
Great to be with you, Steve.
It's been an interesting week for Trump policy watchers. So he's changed his stance on labeling China a currency manipulator, and now he supports the Export-Import Bank and NATO. Steve, what's going on here?
Well, what's going on, I think, first of all, is it's becoming clear to him that being an outsider, a candidate on the campaign trail, and having very stark views on things, it's different than actually governing and getting in there and listening to people and seeing what the real stories are behind a lot of these policies. And so he's had meetings. Well, you talk about China. He's had meetings with the president of China, and his views on that have shifted after those meetings. What's really interesting, though, is I don't think we should be shocked by all of this. Donald Trump may have sounded like a hardliner ideologue while he was a candidate, but if you keep in mind his career as a businessman and you read Art of the Deal, which is a book he wrote 30 years ago, he says he's not really ever wedded to any one approach. And that's the way he sort of run his businesses. And I think coming into the White House, he is really sort of following what he wrote in his book. He's not wedded to the approaches that he was promising on the trail. Now, politically, what will the fallout be from this? We'll see. There are some of his supporters who are not happy with all these shifts.
Is that fair to voters, though? Didn't they vote for Trump on the campaign trail, not a more classical Republican or even a moderate?
Well, it's not for me to decide whether that's fair for voters or not, but we'll have to see how voters react to all of this. Do they like the idea that he's changing now that he is in office? There were a lot of people who weren't happy with some of the things that he was saying on the campaign trail. They thought he was too extreme, had too much ideology behind some of his ideas. Now that he's come in here and he's starting to shift to a more, in some ways, moderate stance on a lot of these things, maybe that attracts some more people. We'll have to see over the coming weeks.
On Russia, President Trump said relations between the U.S. and Russia may be at an all-time low, but he still had some optimism things would work out. Is there much reason to believe that?
It seems as if we are at a low point with the Russian relationship, but we have been for a long time. And what was interesting is throughout the course of the campaign, Trump said, we're going to have a good relationship with Russia. I'll get in there and I'll talk to them and everything will be just fine. And of course, that raised questions about Trump's ties to Russia and Trump's campaign's ties to Russia. But it's not as easy as he was saying it was going to be. In the case of Russia, the reality is it's not going very well. And we'll see where this goes. But it's not going to be talking about optimism and being optimistic isn't necessarily going to change the way things are going now with this relationship.
This is a strange question to ask, but do you think the bad political relationship right now with Russia is in some way a good thing for President Trump politically?
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how it all shakes out within Washington and how people view Donald Trump, because, as I mentioned, there is this swirl of suspicion around Trump and his associates and their relationship to Russia. And so there was this idea that he was basically in the back pocket of Vladimir Putin and others. That's at least what his opponents are saying. And so now that the relationship between U.S. and Russia is at such a negative point, people might be re-asking that question. So was he in the back pocket of Russia, or wasn't he? And was he just being Donald Trump and, again, throwing bluster out there? We'll see. I mean, there are obviously investigations going on with the FBI and on Capitol Hill on Trump's ties to Russia. But it may give him a little bit of political cover. Things not going well with Russia may actually give him a bit of political cover.
What about the reports that we've been seeing about White House infighting? Is Chief Strategist Steve Bannon on the way out?
I think on the way out is a premature way to describe that, but he's definitely not at the level of where he was when they won this election in November. Reporting is showing that Donald Trump was not happy with how Steve Bannon was basically being portrayed as the mastermind behind Trump and the mastermind of the White House. And it seems as if there's been an effort to knock him down a few pegs. There's also been some tension in the relationship between Bannon and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And Kushner's world, it seems to be winning out in terms of that fight. So the question moving forward for Bannon is, he's been marginalized a bit in the White House. Does he continue to deal with that, or does he walk away on his own? It doesn't seem as if there's an imminent dismissal happening here, but it's really going to be how does Steve Bannon handle his lessened role in the White House moving forward? We'll have to keep a close eye on that.
CBS News political director Steve Chigueras, thanks for talking with us, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
The Afghan government says the massive bomb the U.S. dropped there killed 36 ISIS militants. And as you know, it's the most powerful conventional bomb the U.S. has ever used on the battlefield.
It's called the mother of all bombs. And when it was first developed, there was a review of legal justification for its use. In a statement, the U.S. commander in Afghanistan said it was the right munition to use against Islamic State tunnels and caves in Nangarhar province. And the strike, he said, was meant to minimize the risk to Afghan and U.S. forces who are clearing the area.
CBS News correspondent Kimmy McCormick reporting from the Pentagon. As President Trump spends Easter weekend at Mar-a-Lago, tensions are rising in North Korea as the country celebrates the 105th birthday of its founder, Kim Il-sung, who died back in 1994. The White House says the U.S. is poised to respond to any threat from North Korea this weekend. CBS News correspondent Ben Tracy is in Pyongyang.
Vice Minister Han Song-ryol says the situation between the United States and North Korea is the worst it's ever been.
In one word, Trump is openly pursuing a policy to annihilate North Korea by force of arms.
He calls President Trump's decision to send a Navy strike force to the Korean Peninsula, as well as continued U.S. military exercises in the area, provocative acts.
Vice President Mike Pence traveling to South Korea this weekend on a long-planned 10-day trip to Asia. United Airlines is still suffering from the blowback it's gotten after it had Chicago officers drag a passenger off a plane who refused to give up his seat. More from CBS News correspondent Peter King.
I'm Peter King. Will there be a lawsuit?
Yeah, probably.
Attorney Tom Demetrio says he's still gathering evidence. As for Dr. David Dow, Demetrio says he's out of the hospital, but hurting after suffering a concussion, losing two front teeth, and
a serious broken nose. Injury to the sinuses, and he is going to be undergoing shortly reconstructive surgery.
Dow's daughter, Crystal Pepper, says she was horrified, shocked, and sickened to learn of the incident, even more so after seeing the video of Dow being dragged off the plane.
We hope that in the future, nothing like this happens again.
Peter King, CBS News.
Still to come on the Weekend Roundup, drug use in the Navy SEALs.
How do you do that to us?
CBS News investigates. That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. It was a bad week for White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer, who dealt with the fallout from comments he made during a briefing where he said Hitler never used chemical weapons, while comparing him to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
The press secretary calls his own remarks reprehensible. At a museum event, Sean Spicer said he let the president down.
On a, both a personal level and a professional level, that would definitely go down as not a very good day in my history.
The gaffe prompted calls for the president to fire his spokesman. Spicer says he hasn't addressed the matter with Mr. Trump, but hopes all will forgive him. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, the White House.
The Navy SEALs are trying to get a grip on drug use within the ranks, and it's not the only problem the elite force faces. Correspondent David Martin investigates.
I feel like I'm watching our foundation, our culture, erode in front of my eyes.
That's Captain Jamie Sands, commander of SEAL teams based on the East Coast, talking to his men last December.
No more drugs. No more.
People that we know of, that we hear about, have tested positive for cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, marijuana, ecstasy. That's a problem.
Three Navy SEALs, one active duty, two retired, agreed to talk to us on camera if we disguised their faces and substituted their voices to protect them from retribution.
How prevalent is drug abuse in the SEAL teams?
It's growing. The drug use, it's growing.
During the 3 months he had been in charge, Sands kicked five men off the SEAL teams for using drugs. To deal with the problem, he halted training and ordered a safety stand down. All 900 SEALs under his command were required to attend this meeting or watch it online.
But I am angry. I feel betrayed. How do you do that to us?
Before Sands spoke, his chief of staff had rattled off what he called a staggering number of drug cases, which he said showed that the Navy's special operators had a higher incidence of drug use than the rest of the fleet. Why would SEALs, whose lives depend on their physical skills, take drugs?
They think it's okay because they've seen other people do it. They think their teammates won't turn them in. They think it's kind of a cool thing to do, but they think it's okay.
According to these three, SEALs who take drugs don't have to worry about their teammates turning them in.
You stand up for what's right and you get blackballed or driven out. It's a career killer.
And drugs aren't the only problem, according to interviews, emails, and text messages from eight current and former SEALs. There's been a corruption within the teams, one of them wrote. Another said, the death of our quiet professionalism continues to erode at our ethos and endangers our teammates overseas, not to mention our families at home.
The community has got to stop seeking the limelight and exposing what they do, or it continues to put people in danger.
They accused fellow SEALs of profiteering, or as they called it, selling the Trident, a reference to the insignia they earn after making it through basic training.
You don't come out of this, I think, the same.
Fitness routines based on SEAL training have become a cottage industry, as have books by former SEALs.
They're just guys that are going in to try and sell the brand, to sell that Trident on their chest, to make a buck from it. And frankly, if that's all they were doing, so what? But the thing they're selling is information.
These men say movies like Zero Dark Thirty and Captain Phillips are all too accurate in showing the way SEALs operate.
Sir, what's the status on those boats?
One movie, Act of Valor, included active duty SEALs in the cast.
They're coming in hot.
They get all of these sometimes ex-SEALs or active duty SEALs to help make sure it looks as realistic as possible in the process, you know? Unknowingly or knowingly, they're giving away our tactics and procedures.
As long ago as 2012, seven Navy SEALs were disciplined for having worked as paid consultants on the video game Medal of Honor Warfighter.
Video games, do they really give away real tactics?
How we move and, you know, they were pretty accurate for a lot of different things, you know. So, yeah, I would say some of them they do.
Do you ever have to change the way you operate because something's been made public?
Yeah.
It all adds up to a betrayal of the SEAL's own code of conduct.
When I joined the Navy, the brochure said quiet professionals, and that's what I signed up for. But that's not what it is today.
So is fame ruining the SEALs?
I believe that has a lot to do with it.
In response to our story, the Naval Special Warfare Command said we had ignored data which shows their rate of testing positive for drugs is lower than the rest of the Navy. But at that meeting we showed you, the SEAL Chief of Staff used significantly higher numbers, saying there had been 135 drug cases in the past 2 years. He also said that was higher than the rest of the Navy's. There is a video of that speech, but the Navy refused to release it to us.
Meanwhile, one of the country's biggest colleges for fraternities and sororities is trying to rein in Greek life. Here's correspondent Michelle Miller.
Penn State's impressive fraternity and sorority homes are a symbol of long-standing tradition.
17% of the university students are members of Greek life. The school tightened up its party policy earlier this year by banning kegs and hard liquor at parties. Among other things, it also started unannounced compliance checks. In an open letter posted online Monday, Penn State President Dr. Eric Barron said, despite the guidelines, 9 of the university's 82 fraternities and sororities broke rules during Parents Weekend. There are signs that the bad behavior will not end with our rules. It will just go underground.
Never in a million years are they going to close those fraternities down.
Caitlin Flanagan is a contributing editor to The Atlantic.
The fraternities are privately owned organizations. They take place off campus in privately owned houses on privately held land.
According to Penn State, Greek life community members at the college are 4 times more likely to be heavy drinkers, and sorority women are 50% more likely to be sexually assaulted. In February, sophomore Timothy Piazza slipped down a flight of stairs while partying at the Beta Theta Pi fraternity house. He died 2 days later. Penn State banned the chapter after the incident. In 2015, the fraternity Kappa Delta Rho received a 3-year suspension for hazing, selling drugs, underage drinking, and harassing women. And it's not just Penn State. Connor Donnelly, a student at Binghamton University in New York, died while climbing a balcony during a frat party in March. Last fall, Jeff Nepali, a sorority member at the University of Connecticut, was run over and killed after leaving a frat party.
You know where the leadership has to come from? Inside the fraternities themselves.
In a statement to CBS News, Penn State's Interfraternity Council's executive board addressed President Barron, saying, quote, "We would like to work with him on these issues, but expressed disappointment that President Barron chose to write an open letter and post it online rather than talking to the Greek community first."
Up next, as tax day looms, Republicans call on the president to fire the IRS commissioner.
Are you committed to fulfilling your full term?
I'm committed to fulfilling the full term, but I've always said I serve at the pleasure of the president.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS Radio News, the original radio news network, is now on Amazon Alexa. Amazon Alexa. Whether you have the Amazon Echo, Amazon Tap, or Echo Dot, you can listen to our newscasts just by setting CBS Radio News to your flash briefing.
Here's your flash briefing.
Or just ask for CBS News and hear our 24/7 stream through our partners at TuneIn.
This is CBS Radio News on TuneIn.
Wherever you want to listen, CBS Radio News is there.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. This is the last weekend to get your taxes done. They're due Tuesday, April 18th this year. IRS Commissioner John Koskinen is joining us to talk about that. Good to talk to you, Commissioner Koskinen.
Delighted to be here.
So it seems like every year during tax season, there's some sort of IRS outage affecting tax filings or refunds. What's the risk of that happening again soon?
Well, thus far, the filing season has been as smooth as it's ever been.
How does it stack up so far against last year?
We've had just no noticeable outages. People have been able to file easily. Refunds have gone out in a timely manner.
All right. As you know, the White House wants to cut the IRS's budget by 14%. The agency, as you've said yourself, is already stretched thin. What else can you cut?
Well, I think we're to a point where there isn't anything easy to cut. The actual proposal is not a 14% cut. It's a little over a 2% cut, which is obviously much easier to deal with. But we're looking forward to continuing to talk with the administration and the appropriators on the Hill about the IRS needs and the risks of further cuts.
Can you still guarantee the government can collect its money like it does today with more cuts to the agency?
Well, we are concerned over time that as we lose resources, 70% of our budget is people, we can't provide the level of taxpayer service and enforcement that we think is appropriate and necessary.
Republicans on the House Oversight Committee, as you know, have called on President Trump to fire you. You've, of course, long been a target since an IRS official was accused of targeting conservative groups. Tell me, what have your interactions with the president been, and do you have his support?
Since the inauguration, I haven't talked to the president at all. I have worked very closely with the Treasury Secretary. I've made it clear from the time of the election that the important thing is for the administration to find somebody to fill this position before I leave. My term ends in November. I'd be delighted if we could find somebody even earlier than that, because I think continuity is important.
Are you committed to fulfilling your full term?
I'm committed to fulfilling the full term, but I've always said I serve at the pleasure of the president. And I think the important thing is to get somebody available to fill this position.
So do you know if the president is a friend of the IRS?
At this point, I haven't had any conversations with anybody about the president's view of the IRS, so I can't give you any information about that.
So if the president asked you to leave, would you leave?
Yes. I have a fixed term, but it's at the pleasure of the president. And I've made it clear for the last couple of years that I do serve at the pleasure of the president.
And do you want to actually have a conversation with the president?
At this point, my focus has been on managing the agency. We've got filing season with millions of returns yet to come. We're worried about cybersecurity and identity theft, refund fraud. We're dealing with organized crime syndicates around the world. So that's been the focus of my attention.
IRS Commissioner John Kiskinen talking with us. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Now on to a major shift in prostate cancer screening recommendations that may save many more lives.
Larry Blumberg's life changed when his doctor diagnosed him with prostate cancer last year.
We're in time. He said, I'm not sure if we would have been in time if we, had done this a year or two from now.
The 69-year-old's cancer was detected after Larry opted to have a PSA blood test, even though he had no symptoms and the screening was not recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. Now, based on the latest research, the group says men 55 to 69 should have a conversation with their doctor and make a decision for themselves.
Men can reduce their chance of dying of prostate cancer and reduce their chance of having cancer that spreads throughout their body. These are really important benefits, but they occur in a small number of men.
The concern has been that PSA testing results in overdiagnosis and overtreating cancers, which can lead to serious issues like impotence and incontinence. Dr. Herbert Lepore says advances in detection and closely monitoring low-risk cancers are helping men avoid drastic treatment.
We can decrease the number of men who will undergo an unnecessary biopsy, and we have better tools to really assess the aggressiveness of the cancer.
Larry needed surgery to remove his prostate. He's had some side effects, but says they're getting better.
The side effects are nothing compared to the fact that, I'm going to live a long life and enjoy my kids and my grandchildren.
Larry is cancer-free, and his PSA is undetectable. Kenneth Craig, CBS News, New York.
It was an exciting moment for golf at the Masters. Our Steve Futterman was there.
After nearly 20 years of trying, after years of high expectations and repeated disappointments, Sergio Garcia finally won a major championship.
Once and for all for Sergio.
The 37-year-old Garcia beat England's Justin Rose on the first playoff hole to end his long drought. It was a day full of drama for Garcia.
That's an eagle to get him to 9 under.
At times, there were moments where it looked like it would be Garcia's day. An eagle on the 15th to tie the contest with just 3 holes left. But there were other times where it looked like it would be the same old story. On the final hole of regulation, Garcia with a chance to win.
He thought that ball would fall left. It stayed outside right.
Garcia missed a relatively easy 7-foot putt. That forced the playoff and set the stage for Garcia's dramatic win.
Sergio Garcia has won his first major.
For Garcia, there was both elation and relief.
It's been a long wait, but it's that much sweeter because of that wait.
Then came the culminating moment.
Danny, I would be grateful if you would place the green jacket on Sergio.
Today, Garcia is wearing the green jacket, and with that, he has removed the label of being the best golfer never to have won a major. Steve Futterman, CBS News at the Masters in Augusta.
A new frontier in technology, biohacking. Correspondent John Blackstone explains.
In a Stockholm business complex, employees gain access not with key cards, but with a wave of a hand.
This is something that you can use just like a key badge.
At a recent tech conference, Hannes Schoblad explained how a microchip implanted in his hand makes his life easier.
I use this many times a day, for example, to unlock my smartphone, to open the door to my office.
Schoblad calls himself a biohacker.
We biohackers, we think that the human body is a good start, but there is certainly room for improvement.
The first step in that improvement is getting a microchip about the size of a grain of rice slipped under the skin. The microchips are radio frequency identification tags, the same technology widely used in things like key cards.
It also seems to be one thing if retailers can track me on my phone to see if they can get me to buy some socks or underwear. It's a different thing if my employer can see where I am, see what I'm doing when I'm off the job.
Even a dedicated biohacker has concerns.
It's very easy to hack a chip implant, so my advice is don't put your life secrets on a chip implant.
For now, being chipped means never having to say you're sorry you forgot your key card.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, life and laughs on the road.
It's a hard job to complain about, really. I mean, even though my book is full of complaints.
Please follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS Radio News, and I'm at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Life on the road can open up a whole new perspective on life outside the bubble, you know, the D.C., New York, L.A. lives millions of us live. Comedian Todd Barry wrote a book about his year touring secondary markets, the Madison, Wisconsin's and Missoula, Montana's of the U.S. It's called Thank You for Coming to Hattiesburg. Thanks for talking with us, Todd.
Thanks for having me.
Do you really think there is a bubble we've been hearing about, perhaps the same one we heard about in the presidential election?
I do think there are people who do live in a bubble, people I've met in New York, and opinion-wise, they'll wipe out entire regions of the country based on what they think it's like there. And, you know, like when I mentioned this in the book, when I was going to Little Rock, Arkansas, I posted something about it on Facebook, and someone wrote, "Oh, that's a tough crowd for your intellectual wit," something like that. And I was like, the show hasn't even happened yet. How do you know it's a tough crowd? And it's just people have these preconceptions.
How do you think, if at all, middle America is different from the coasts?
I think I sort of make this point in the book that it's kind of just the same to me.
They all have the same Netflix, the same computer, the same TV.
Yeah, I mean, you can find, like, even if you're I don't do political comedy, but even all the red states have, you know, a significant amount of people who are progressive and might be like-minded with you on things.
You try not to romanticize life on the road. You talk about addressing dirty toilets.
Aside from the occasional dirty toilet and, you know, dressing room oversight, it's a hard job to complain about, really. I mean, even though my book is full of complaints, but they're kind of minor complaints. I go on stage and I tell jokes for a living, and then I get pretty good money and, you know, people saying nice things to me. So,
but, you know, there's some comedians I understand that go out on the road and they think of it as a job. They go to their hotel room and they go to the club and then they just fly right back out. It seems like in the book that you take time to go to coffee places, to go out at night with friends and other comedians.
Yeah.
Is that common?
I mean, there are definitely comedians I know, and I never quite understand this, who will just stay in their room all day. And I just feel like no matter what city you're in, why don't you try to find something that you haven't seen before? And I don't go on wild adventures and I don't like plot out my day, but, you know, I will go to a coffee shop and sit for 2 hours and then go for a walk and try to hunt down some food afterwards. But why travel if you're not going to explore where you're going, where you end up?
And what about these comedy club condos? You talk a little bit about in the book about them. Are they so bad?
That's not something I deal with anymore, but
it sounds nice. I'd prefer a condo to a hotel room, at least a Motel 6.
Well, I think you'd have to stay at a comedy condo to realize it. I mean, I think that the word condo might be putting an image in your head that's a little more romantic, because they call anything a condo. You know, they could have the worst apartment in the worst apartment complex, and they'll go, "It's the comedy condo." And it all depends. Like, if you go to a club and they just opened and only a limited amount of damage can be done to that condo, then it's fine. But to me, I just don't want to. The thing I didn't like about them is, like, they're always questionable what's gone on in there. I mean, I know that stuff goes on in hotels, but also you just show up and it's like, you know, there's a half a bag of hot dog buns that have a little twist tie around them and from the previous guy who cooked while you were there. It's just not what I want.
So it's not as glamorous.
Yeah, there's no one I think would ever describe comedy condos as glamorous. They're there for a reason. It's because the club wants to save money.
How hit or miss is it working with comedy clubs? You talk about some excellent owners and promoters and some ones that aren't really quite as organized or professional.
Yeah. I mean, I've stayed away from a lot of the chain comedy clubs in the past few years just because it's focusing more on going to a music venue or a little theater where I get basically all people who know me and want to see me, as opposed to if you go to a comedy club in, you know, Ohio or anywhere really, and they have six shows scheduled in a city where maybe 200 people at the most really want to see you, then it's just they have to fill those seats, and then it gets that's when things get dicey, because you just kind of get people who are like, oh, you just got free tickets.
I want to talk about your career for a minute. You've been doing this since what, 1987?
Yeah.
So you now have a special on Netflix. You've been to Tel Aviv, Australia, Canada. You've been on TV. Do you feel like your career has accelerated in the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been what I would, you know, I'm kind of a slow burn. Like, I've been doing it, it's going to be 30 years in November. And, you know, a certain amount of people know who I am, and I get a certain amount of recognition, but I haven't had that huge, what one might call a break. But I sort of think you should, you know, I try to savor what I have accomplished, which is pretty good. But I mean, some people define a comedy career based on whether you've had your own show or not. And I don't think that's the only way to define it for me anyway.
Do you ever get frustrated when you see new comics really burn quickly and then move on to movies or something really big?
I mean, I try not to be too bitter or unappreciative of what I've got. But yeah, there's sometimes you see someone where you just know they've paid very few dues. And
right.
They're not going to sit around and tell, you know, road stories about horrible shows they've had or getting stuff thrown at them because they sort of have a charmed career. But it doesn't affect my career if someone has a quicker rise than I do, really.
So 30 years on the road, that's impressive in any career. What's kept you in it?
It's sort of, I don't want to be one to feel like, oh, I don't know anything else. There's nothing else I could possibly do. But I just feel like, why not? I don't, what else is there? It's what I'm fairly decent at, and yeah, it's a living, and it's kind of a cool job.
You don't do jokes about politics, but do you follow politics?
Yeah, I mean, I keep MSNBC on, you know, that's mainly what I watch, and I try to take it in as much as possible, but I just want to avoid being heavy-handed, and more importantly, I want to avoid looking stupid, because I feel like sometimes you'll hear someone in show business kind of, you know, rant about something and you kind of go, I think they sort of know what they're talking about, but I bet if I really dug deeper, they might not be able to talk about this much longer.
Now, you have kind of a subtle brand, would you say, of comedy?
Yeah, some people would say that. That's a nicer way to put it. I do think there is a perception of someone who's low energy that they can't fill a room, and it's just not true for the most part. I mean, if you have a microphone that works and people are listening, then, and you say stuff that's funny, then you're going to be fine. It's been more of a problem offstage than it has been onstage. Like, my shows haven't suffered much from my low energy. There are, you know, there's always going to be people who are like, I've heard people that I need a high energy show. It's like, okay, well, then there's plenty of comics who will give you that, and go enjoy them.
Comedian Todd Barry, he wrote the book, Thank You for Coming to Hattiesburg. Thanks for your time, Todd.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up,
let the future generation say, we were the ones who stood up.
Standing up to the Taliban and becoming a voice for millions of girls on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Check out CBS Radio News podcasts. From hard news to features, there's lots available from our app. Listen to experts like John Dickerson each Sunday on Face the Nation or Scott Pelley every weeknight on the CBS Evening News. There's the World News Roundup, America's longest-running network newscast, and the Weekend Roundup, our Week in Review magazine show. It's all available from CBSRadioNews.com or on our app for iOS and Android.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. It was a big week for Malala Yousafzai. You may remember she was the Afghan girl who was shot by the Taliban as she was on her way to school. On Monday, she was named the youngest ever United Nations Messenger of Peace, focusing on girls' education. She also spoke to Canada's parliament.
Let the future generation say, we were the ones who stood up. Let them say, we were the first ones. We were the first to live in a world where all girls could learn and lead without fear. Let us be the ones who bring that change we want to see.
Yousefzai is now 19. She's since written a book about her life and won the Nobel Peace Prize. She spoke to Nora O'Donnell at the UN.
Well, welcome. We're going to sit down right here.
The UN rarely shuts down the General Assembly Hall for a television interview. But for Malala Yousefzai, the world body made an exception. The survivor of a 2012 Taliban attack has demonstrated comfort on the global stage, addressing the most complex issues.
President Trump twice tried to issue an immigration ban or a travel ban on refugees from majority Muslim countries. What message do you think that sent?
Well, when President banned Muslim majority countries, that was really disappointing, and I was deeply hurt because I'm a Muslim, and to me it just seemed like directly blaming Muslims, and that is not a solution. That is just making an excuse and hiding from the real problems. I think he needs to understand that you need to meet the people. You need to see the refugee people.
Malala has done just that, spending her 19th birthday with Somalian refugees in Kenya. She also visited a Syrian refugee camp in Jordan.
They're dying, whether they're in Syria or any other country. They're dying, they're being killed. And if you don't open the doors, if you don't welcome them, they would be killed. So it's important that he understand that these people are in need. And I have seen them. I have went to refugee camp. And I think he needs to go to these refugee camps.
You think President Trump needs to go to a refugee camp?
I definitely agree with that. President Donald Trump needs to go and see refugee children. He needs to go and visit the refugee camps. He needs to know what a real life is like in a refugee camp.
We saw the horrifying images of the chemical attack in Syria. And the U.S. later bombed a Syrian airbase in what the White House called a proportional response. Did you see those pictures?
It is shocking what's happening in Syria, but we need to remember that this happens each and every day, whether that's through chemical weapon or any other weapon. The number of people who have been killed is in hundreds and thousands, and it has been happening for more than 5 to 6 years. And the world is being silent, and I think we need to remind our leaders that this is a serious issue. We need to think ahead. We need to think about preventing wars from starting as well. And I think for that, investment in education is the key, investing especially in the education of women and girls.
There's a direct relationship between illiteracy,
yes,
and terrorism.
With education comes questioning. With education comes critical thinking. With education comes more opportunities. People go forward. People see in the world from a different perspective.
But Malala, there are 130 million girls who do not have access to school.
It is shocking that 130 million girls are not in school. And when we talk about going forward and achieving like developments, it is not possible without empowering these 130 million girls. But I just wonder, like, why do these leaders not see this?
Back in her adopted home in the UK, Malala is finishing up her final exams. She tells us she'd like to attend the alma mater of her hero, Benazir Bhutto, Pakistan's first female prime minister.
So I had an interview for Oxford, and it was the hardest interview. The hardest.
Of your life?
It was.
Why?
Because they ask you really hard questions.
I find it hard to believe that anything's hard for you, Malala.
No, but it's different. It's not a TV interview. It's a different interview. They ask you hard questions.
Yeah. A lot of academic questions.
Academic questions, yeah.
Yeah. But you would like to go to Oxford?
If I get the grades.
Yeah, if you get the grades.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you've said you would like to be prime minister one day.
I did say, but I'm not sure. Let's see what time tells. Yeah.
You're dialing back on that?
I'm not sure. It's just a bit too much.
A bit too much?
Yeah, I'm going to be focused on my university now.
Malala Yousefzai speaking with our Nora O'Donnell at the UN. Now to our parting shot this weekend. The White House has ordered 40,000 commemorative Easter eggs for its annual egg roll on the South Lawn on Monday. They're from Wells Wood Turning Company. That's up in Maine. Simon Varney is co-owner and vice president. Simon, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
So tell us about these eggs. These aren't just any eggs you would find at a Rite Aid or a Walmart for Easter egg rolls.
No, they're not at all. They are custom-made eggs made right here at the mill in Buckfield, Maine. And our 30 or so employees have been making the eggs for the White House since 2007. And they're made right here at the mill. We turn the eggs on a high-capacity lathe machine. We trim the buds to give it the egg shape. We paint them right here. And then we also pad print them. So each egg has a unique piece of artwork on the front, and then the signatures of the president and the first lady on the back.
What's usually the image?
The image varies from year to year. This year, there's a very nice image of the White House building itself on the front, and as I said, signatures on the back. Those are in the pastel eggs, so there are four pastel colors. The gold egg has the presidential seal on the front of the egg, and again, the two signatures on the back. So there are four pastels this year, pink, blue, green, and yellow, as well as the gold egg.
Is this a competitive thing to get the White House to buy your eggs? I mean, how much of an industry is there in Easter egg design?
I'd say there are a few of us out there. There are some few wood-turning mills still in operation around the country. So there are a few of us who can provide the eggs. But we've been fortunate enough, if you will, to be able to provide a high-quality product, I guess. And our team, you know, our experienced employees have been doing this for, as I say, since 2007. So our folks are, you know, experts in getting their job done. So we're very fortunate that way.
Simon Varney, he runs Wells Wood Turning Company up in Maine and is providing this year's Easter eggs for the annual Easter egg roll at the White House. Thanks, Simon.
Yeah, thanks very much. Glad to talk to you.
That does it for the Weekend Roundup. We appreciate you listening to this week's show. Please keep in mind you can do a search online anytime to find past episodes. Search for CBS News Weekend Roundup. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.